Chapter 25. Snug.
Have you the lion's part written? Pray you, if it be, give it me, for I am slow of study.
Quince. You may do it extempore, for it is nothing but roaring.
Midsummer Night's Dream. There was a strange blending of the ridiculous with that which was solemn in this scene. The beast still continued its rolling and apparently untiring movements, though its ludicrous attempt to imitate the melody of David ceased the instant the latter abandoned the field. The words of Gamut were, as has been seen, in his native tongue, and to Duncan they seemed pregnant with some hidden meaning, though nothing present assisted him in discovering the object of their illusion. A speedy end was, however, put to every conjecture on the subject by the manner of the chief, who advanced to the bedside of the invalid, and beckoned away the whole group of female attendants that had clustered there to witness the skill of the stranger. He was implicitly, though reluctantly, obeyed, and when the low echo, which rang along the hollow natural gallery from the distant closing door, had ceased, pointing towards his insensible daughter, he said, "Now let my brother show his power." Thus unequivocally called on to exercise the functions of his assumed character, Hayward was apprehensive that the smallest delay might prove dangerous. Endeavoring then to collect his ideas, he prepared to perform that species of incantation and those uncouth rites under which the Indian conjurers are accustomed to conceal their ignorance and impotency. It is more than probable that, in the disordered state of his thoughts, he would soon have fallen into some suspicious, if not fatal, error, had not his incipient attempts been interrupted by a fierce growl from the quadruped. Three several times did he renew his efforts to proceed, and as often was he met by the same unaccountable opposition, each interruption seeming more savage and threatening than the preceding.
"The cunning ones are jealous," said the Huron. "I go. Brother, the woman is the wife of one of my bravest young men. Deal justly by her. Peace," he added, beckoning to the discontented beast to be quiet. "I go."
The chief was as good as his word, and Duncan now found himself alone in that wild and desolate abode with the helpless invalid and the fierce and dangerous brute. The latter listened to the movements of the Indian with that air of sagacity that a bear is known to possess, until another echo announced that he had also left the cavern, when it turned and came waddling up to Duncan, before whom it seated itself in its natural attitude, erect like a man. The youth looked anxiously about him for some weapon with which he might make a resistance against the attack he now seriously expected. It seemed, however, as if the humor of the animal had suddenly changed. Instead of continuing its discontented growls or manifesting any further signs of anger, the whole of its shaggy body shook violently as if agitated by some strange internal convulsion. The huge and unwieldy talons pawed stupidly about the grinning muzzle, and while Hayward kept his eyes riveted on its movements with jealous watchfulness, the grim head fell on one side, and in its place appeared the honest, sturdy countenance of the scout, who was indulging from the bottom of his soul in his own peculiar expression of merriment.
"Hist!" said the wary woodsman, interrupting Hayward's exclamation of surprise. "The varlets are about the place, and any sounds that are not natural to witchcraft would bring them back upon us in a body.
Tell me the meaning of this masquerade, and why you have attempted so desperate an adventure."
"Ah, reason and calculation are often outdone by accident," returned the scout. "But as a story should always commence at the beginning, I will tell you the whole in order. After we parted, I placed the commandant and the sagamore in an old beaver lodge, where they are safer from the Hurons than they would be in the garrison of Edward, for your high northwest Indians, not having as yet got the traders among them, continue to venerate the beaver. After which Uncas and I pushed for the other encampment, as was agreed. Have you seen the lad?"
"To my great grief, he is captive and condemned to die at the rising of the sun."
"I had misgivings that such would be his fate," resumed the scout in a less confident and joyous tone. But soon regaining his naturally firm voice, he continued, "His bad fortune is the true reason of my being here, for it would never do to abandon such a boy to the Hurons. A rare time the knaves would have of it, could they tie the bounding elk and the long carabine, as they call me, to the same stake, Though why they have given me such a name I never knew, there being as little likeness between the gifts of Killdeer and the performance of one of your real Canada carabines as there is between the nature of a pipestone and a flint.
Keep to your tale, said the impatient Hayward. We know not at what moment the Hurons may return.
No fear of them. A conjurer must have his time, like a straggling priest in the settlements. We are as safe from interruption as a missionary would be at the beginning of a 2 hours' discourse. Well, Uncas and I fell in with a return party of the varlets. The lad was much too forward for a scout. Nay, for that matter, being of hot blood, he was not so much to blame. And after all, one of the Hurons proved a coward, and in fleeing led him into an ambushment. And dearly has he paid for the weakness. The scout significantly passed his hand across his own throat and nodded, as if he said, I comprehend your meaning. After which he continued in a more audible, though scarcely more intelligible, language. After the loss of the boy, I turned upon the Hurons, as you may judge. There have been scrimmages between one or two of their outliers and myself, but that is neither here nor there. So after I had shot the imps, I got in pretty nigh to the lodges without further commotion. Then what should luck do in my favor but lead me to the very spot where one of the most famous conjurers of the tribe was dressing himself, as I well knew, for some great battle with Satan, though why should I call that luck, which it now seems was an especial ordering of Providence? So a judgmatical rap over the head stiffened the lying impostor for a time, and leaving him a bit of walnut for his supper, to prevent an uproar, and stringing him up between two saplings, I made free with his finery, and took the part of the bear on myself in order that the operations might proceed.
And admirably did you enact the character. The animal itself might have been shamed by the representation.
Lord, Major, returned the flattered woodsman, I should be but a poor scholar for one who has studied so long in the wilderness did I not know how to set forth the movements and nature of such a beast. Had it been now a catamount, or even a full-sized panther, I would have embellished a performance for you worth regarding. But it is no such marvelous feat to exhibit the feats of so dull a beast, though for that matter, too, a bear may be overacted. Yes, yes, it is not every imitator that knows nature may be outdone easier than she is equaled. But all our work is yet before us. Where is the gentle one?
Heaven knows. I have examined every lodge in the village without discovering the slightest trace of her presence in the tribe.
You heard what the singer said as he left us. She is at hand and expects you.
I have been compelled to believe he alluded to this unhappy woman.
The simpleton was frightened and blundered through his message, but he had a deeper meaning. Here are walls enough to separate the whole settlement. A bear ought to climb, therefore will I take a look above them. There may be honey pots hid in these rocks, and I am a beast, you know, that has a hankering for the sweets. The scout looked behind him, laughing at his own conceit, while he clambered up the partition, imitating as he went the clumsy motions of the beast he represented. But the instant the summit was gained, he made a gesture for silence, and slid down with the utmost precipitation.
She is here, he whispered,
and by that door you will find her. I would have spoken a word of comfort to the afflicted soul, but the sight of such a monster might upset her reason. Though for that matter, Major, you are none of the most inviting yourself in your paint. Duncan, who had already sprung eagerly forward, drew instantly back on hearing these discouraging words.
Am I, then, so very revolting?
He demanded with an air of chagrin. You might not startle a wolf, or turn the Royal Americans from a charge, but I have seen the time when you had a better favored look. Your streaked countenances are not ill-judged of by the squaws, but young women of white blood give the preference to their own color. See, he added, pointing to a place where the water trickled from a rock, forming a little crystal spring before it found an issue through the adjacent crevices. You may easily get rid of the sagamore's daub, and when you come back, I will try my hand at a new embellishment. It's as common for a conjurer to alter his paint as for a buck in the settlements to change his finery. The deliberate woodsman had little occasion to hunt for arguments to enforce his advice. He was yet speaking when Duncan availed himself of the water. In a moment, every frightful or offensive mark was obliterated, and the youth appeared again in the lineaments with which he had been gifted by nature. thus prepared for an interview with his mistress, he took a hasty leave of his companion and disappeared through the indicated passage. The scout witnessed his departure with complacency, nodding his head after him and muttering his good wishes, after which he very coolly set about an examination of the state of the larder among the Hurons, the cavern, among other purposes, being used as a receptacle for the fruits of their hunts. Duncan had no other guide than a distant glimmering light, which served, however, the office of a polar star to the lover. By its aid he was enabled to enter the haven of his hopes, which was merely another apartment of the cavern that had been solely appropriated to the safekeeping of so important a prisoner as a daughter of the commandant of William Henry. It was profusely strewed with the plunder of that unlucky fortress. In the midst of this confusion he found her he sought, pale, anxious, and terrified, but lovely. David had prepared her for such a visit.
"Duncan!"
she exclaimed, in a voice that seemed to tremble at the sounds created by itself.
"Alice,"
he answered, leaping carelessly among trunks, boxes, arms, and furniture until he stood at her side.
"I knew that you would never desert me,"
she said, looking up with a momentary glow on her otherwise dejected countenance.
"But you are alone. Grateful as it is to be thus remembered, I could wish to think you are not entirely alone."
Duncan, observing that she trembled in a manner which betrayed her inability to stand, gently induced her to be seated, while he recounted those leading incidents which it has been our task to record. Alice listened with breathless interest, and though the young man touched lightly on the sorrows of the stricken father, taking care, however, not to wound the self-love of his auditor, the tears ran as freely down the cheeks of the daughter as though she had never wept before. The soothing tenderness of Duncan, however, soon quieted the first burst of her emotions, and she then heard him to the close with undivided attention, if not with composure. "And now, Alice," he added, "you will see how much is still expected of you. By the assistance of our experienced and invaluable friend, the scout, we may find our way from this savage people, but you will have to exert your utmost fortitude. Remember that you fly to the arms of your venerable parent, and how much his happiness, as well as your own, depends on those exertions."
"Can I do otherwise for a father who has done so much for me?"
"And for me, too," continued the youth, gently pressing the hand he held in both his own. The look of innocence and surprise which he received in return convinced Duncan of the necessity of being more explicit. "This is neither the place nor the occasion to detain you with selfish wishes," he added. "But what heart, loaded like mine, would not wish to cast its burden? They say misery is the closest of all ties. Our common suffering in your behalf left but little to be explained between your father and myself."
"And dearest Cora, Duncan, surely Cora was not forgotten?"
"Not forgotten, no. Regretted, as woman was seldom mourned before. Your venerable father knew no difference between his children. But I, Alice, you will not be offended when I say that to me her worth was in a degree obscured."
"Then you knew not the merit of my sister,"
said Alice, withdrawing her hand.
"Of you she ever speaks as of one who is her nearest friend."
"I would gladly believe her such," returned Duncan hastily. "I could wish her to be even more. But with you, Alice, I have the permission of your father to aspire to a still nearer and dearer tie." Alice trembled violently, and there was an instant during which she bent her face aside, yielding to the emotions common to her sex. But they quickly passed away, leaving her mistress of her deportment, if not of her affections.
"Hayward,"
she said, looking him full in the face with a touching expression of innocence and dependency,
"give me the sacred presence and the holy sanction of that parent before you urge me further."
Though more I should not, less I could not say, the youth was about to answer, when he was interrupted by a light tap on his shoulder. Starting to his feet, he turned, and confronting the intruder, his looks fell on the dark form and malignant visage of Magua. The deep, guttural laugh of the savage sounded at such a moment to Duncan like the hellish taunt of a demon. Had he pursued the sudden and fierce impulse of the instant, he would have cast himself on the Huron and committed their fortunes to the issue of a deadly struggle. but without arms of any description, ignorant of what succor his subtle enemy could command, and charged with the safety of one who was just then dearer than ever to his heart, he no sooner entertained than he abandoned the desperate intention.
"What is your purpose?"
said Alice, meekly folding her arms on her bosom, and struggling to conceal an agony of apprehension in behalf of Hayward, in the usual cold and distant manner with which she received the visits of her captor. The exulting Indian had resumed his austere countenance, though he drew warily back before the menacing glance of the young man's fiery eye. He regarded both his captives for a moment with a steady look, and then, stepping aside, he dropped a log of wood across a door different from that by which Duncan had entered. The latter now comprehended the manner of his surprise, and believing himself irretrievably lost, he drew Alice to his bosom, and stood prepared to meet a fate which he hardly regretted, since it was to be suffered in such company. But Magua meditated no immediate violence. His first measures were very evidently taken to secure his new captive, nor did he even bestow a second glance at the motionless forms in the center of the cavern until he had completely cut off every hope of retreat through the private outlet he had himself used. He was watched in all his movements by Hayward, who, however, remained firm, still folding the fragile form of Alice to his heart, at once too proud and too hopeless to ask favor of an enemy so often foiled. When Magua had effected his object, he approached his prisoners and said in English, "The palefaces trap the cunning beavers, but the redskins know how to take the Yengeese."
"Huron, do your worst,"
exclaimed the excited Hayward, forgetful that a double stake was involved in his life. "You and your vengeance are alike despised." "Will the white man speak these words at the stake?" asked Magua, manifesting at the same time how little faith he had in the other's resolution by the sneer that accompanied his words.
"Here, singly to your face, or in the presence of your nation?"
"Lurena Sutil is a great chief," returned the Indian. "He will go and bring his young men to see how bravely a pale face can laugh at the tortures."
He turned away while speaking and was about to leave the place through the avenue by which Duncan had approached, when a growl caught his ear and caused him to hesitate. The figure of the bear appeared in the door, where it sat, rolling from side to side in its customary restlessness. Magua, like the father of the sick woman, eyed it keenly for a moment as if to ascertain its character. He was far above the more vulgar superstitions of his tribe, and so soon as he recognized the well-known attire of the conjurer, he prepared to pass it in cool contempt. But a louder and more threatening growl caused him again to pause. Then he seemed as if suddenly resolved to trifle no longer, and moved resolutely forward. The mimic animal, which had advanced a little, retired slowly in his front until it arrived again at the pass, when, rearing on its hinder legs, it beat the air with its paws in the manner practiced by its brutal prototype.
"Fool!" exclaimed the chief in Huron. "Go play with the children and squaws. Leave men to their wisdom."
He once more endeavored to pass the supposed empiric, scorning even the parade of threatening to use the knife or tomahawk that was pendant from his belt. Suddenly the beast extended its arms, or rather legs, and enclosed him in a grasp that might have vied with the far-famed power of the bear's hug itself. Hayward had watched the whole procedure on the part of Hawkeye with breathless interest. At first he relinquished his hold of Alice, then he caught up a thong of buckskin which had been used around some bundle, and when he beheld his enemy with his two arms pinned to his side by the iron muscles of the scout, he rushed upon him and effectually secured them there. Arms, legs, and feet were encircled in 20 folds of the thong in less time than we have taken to record the circumstance. When the formidable Huron was completely pinioned, the scout released his hold, and Duncan laid his enemy on his back, utterly helpless. Throughout the whole of this sudden and extraordinary operation, Magua, though he had struggled violently, until assured he was in the hands of one whose nerves were far better strung than his own, had not uttered the slightest exclamation. But when Hawkeye, by way of making a summary explanation of his conduct, removed the shaggy jaws of the beast and exposed his own rugged and earnest countenance to the gaze of the Huron, the philosophy of the latter was so far mastered as to permit him to utter the never-failing, "Huh!"
"Aye, you found your tongue," said his undisturbed conqueror. "Now, in order that you shall not use it to our ruin, I must make free to stop your mouth." As there was no time to be lost, the scout immediately set about effecting so necessary a precaution, and when he had gagged the Indian, his enemy might safely have been considered as hors de combat. "By what place did the imp enter?" asked the industrious scout when his work was ended. "Not a soul has passed my way since you left me." Duncan pointed out the door by which Magua had come, and which now presented too many obstacles to a quick retreat. "Bring on the gentle one, then," continued his friend. "We must make a push for the woods by the other outlet."
"'Tis impossible," said Duncan. "Fear has overcome her, and she is helpless. Alice, my sweet, my own Alice, arouse yourself. Now is the moment to fly." "'Tis in vain. She hears, but is unable to follow. Go, noble and worthy friend. Save yourself, and leave me to my fate."
"Every trail has its end, and every calamity brings its lesson," returned the scout. "There, wrap her in them Indian cloths. Conceal all of her little form. Nay, that foot has no fellow in the wilderness. It will betray her. All, every part. Now take her in your arms and follow. Leave the rest to me."
Duncan, as may be gathered from the words of his companion, was eagerly obeying, and as the other finished speaking, he took the light person of Alice in his arms and followed on the footsteps of the scout. They found the sick woman as they had left her, still alone, and passed swiftly on by the natural gallery to the place of entrance. As they approached the little door of bark, a murmur of voices without announced that the friends and relatives of the invalid were gathered about the place, patiently awaiting a summons to re-enter.
"If I open my lips to speak," Hawkeye whispered, "my English, which is the genuine tongue of a white skin, will tell the varlets that an enemy is among them. You must give them your jargon, Major, and say that we have shut the evil spirit in the cave and are taking the woman to the woods in order to find strengthening roots. Practice all your cunning, for it is a lawful undertaking."
The door opened a little, as if one without was listening to the proceedings within, and compelled the scout to cease his directions. A fierce growl repelled the eavesdropper, and then the scout boldly threw open the covering of bark and left the place, enacting the character of the bear as he proceeded. Duncan kept close at his heels, and so found himself in the center of a cluster of 20 anxious relatives and friends. The crowd fell back a little, and permitted the father and one who appeared to be the husband of the woman to approach.
"Has my brother driven away the evil spirit?" demanded the former. "What has he in his arms?"
"Thy child," returned Duncan gravely. "The disease has gone out of her. It is shut up in the rocks. I take the woman to a distance where I will strengthen her against any further attacks. She shall be in the wigwam of the young man when the sun comes again."
When the father had translated the meaning of the stranger's words into the Huron language, a suppressed murmur announced the satisfaction with which the intelligence was received. The chief himself waved his hand for Duncan to proceed, saying aloud, in a firm voice and with a lofty manner,
"Go! I am a man, and I will enter the rock and fight the wicked one."
Hayward had gladly obeyed and was already past the little group when these startling words arrested him.
"Is my brother mad?" he exclaimed. "Is he cruel? He will meet the disease, and it will enter him. Or he will drive out the disease, and it will chase his daughter into the woods. No, let my children wait without, and if the spirit appears, beat him down with clubs. He is cunning, and will bury himself in the mountain when he sees how many are ready to fight him."
This singular warning had the desired effect. Instead of entering the cavern, the father and husband drew their tomahawks and posted themselves in readiness to deal their vengeance on the imaginary tormentor of their sick relative, while the women and children broke branches from the bushes or seized fragments of the rock with a similar intention. At this favorable moment, the counterfeit conjurers disappeared. Hawkeye, at the same time that he had presumed so far on the nature of the Indian superstitions, was not ignorant that they were rather tolerated than relied on by the wisest of the chiefs. He well knew the value of time in the present emergency. Whatever might be the extent of the self-delusion of his enemies, and however it had tended to assist his schemes, the slightest cause of suspicion, acting on the subtle nature of an Indian, would be likely to prove fatal. Taking the path, therefore, that was most likely to avoid observation, he rather skirted than entered the village. The warriors were still to be seen in the distance by the fading light of the fires stalking from lodge to lodge, but the children had abandoned their sports for their beds of skins, and the quiet of night was already beginning to prevail over the turbulence and excitement of so busy and important an evening. Alice revived under the renovating influence of the open air, and as her physical rather than her mental powers had been the subject of weakness, she stood in no need of any explanation of that which had occurred.
"Now let me make an effort to walk," she said,
when they had entered the forest, blushing, though unseen, that she had not been sooner able to quit the arms of Duncan.
"I am indeed restored."
"Nay, Alice, you are yet too weak." The maiden struggled gently to release herself, and Hayward was compelled to part with his precious burden. The representative of the bear had certainly been an entire stranger to the delicious emotions of the lover while his arms encircled his mistress, and he was perhaps a stranger also to the nature of that feeling of ingenuous shame that oppressed the trembling Alice. But when he found himself at a suitable distance from the lodges, he made a halt and spoke on a subject of which he was thoroughly the master. "This path will lead you to the brook," he said. "Follow its northern bank until you come to a fall, and mount the hill on your right, and you will see the fires of the other people. There you must go and demand protection. If they are true Delawares, you will be safe. A distant flight with that gentle one just now is impossible. The Hurons would follow up our trail and master our scalps before we had got a dozen miles. Go, and Providence be with you."
"And you?" demanded Hayward in surprise. "Surely we part not here."
"The Hurons hold the pride of the Delawares. The last of the high blood of the Mohicans is in their power," returned the scout. "I go to see what can be done in his favor. Had they mastered your scalp, Major, a knave should have fallen for every hair it held, as I promised. But if the young Sagamore is to be led to the stake, the Indians shall see also how a man without a cross can die." Not in the least offended with the decided preference that the sturdy woodsman gave to one who might in some degree be called the child of his adoption, Duncan still continued to urge such reasons against so desperate an effort as presented themselves. He was aided by Alice, who mingled her entreaties with those of Hayward, that he would abandon a resolution that promised so much danger with so little hope of success. Their eloquence and ingenuity were expended in vain. The scout heard them attentively but impatiently, and finally closed the discussion by answering in a tone that instantly silenced Alice, while it told Hayward how fruitless any further remonstrances would be. "I have heard," he said, "that there is a feeling in youth which binds man to woman closer than the father is tied to the son. It may be so. I have seldom been where women of my color dwell, but such may be the gifts of nature in the settlements. You have risked life and all that is dear to you to bring off this gentle one, and I suppose that some such disposition is at the bottom of it all. As for me, I taught the lad the real character of a rifle, and well has he paid me for it. I have fought at his side in many a bloody scrimmage, and so long as I could hear the crack of his piece in one ear and that of the Sagamore in the other, I knew no enemy was on my back. Winters and summers, nights and days have we roved the wilderness in company, eating of the same dish, one sleeping while the other watched. And afore it shall be said that Uncas was taken to the torment and I at hand, there is but a single ruler of us all, whatever may be the color of the skin. And him I call to witness that before the Mohican boy shall perish for the want of a friend, good faith shall depart the earth, and killdeer become as harmless as the tooting weapon of the singer." Duncan released his hold on the arm of the scout, who turned and steadily retraced his steps towards the lodges. After pausing a moment to gaze at his retiring form, the successful and yet sorrowful Hayward and Alice took their way together towards the distant village of the Delawares. Chapter 26 Bottom.
"Let me play the lion, too." Midsummer Night's Dream.
Notwithstanding the high resolution of Hawkeye, He fully comprehended all the difficulties and dangers he was about to incur. In his return to the camp, his acute and practiced intellects were intently engaged in devising means to counteract a watchfulness and suspicion on the part of his enemies that he knew were in no degree inferior to his own. Nothing but the color of his skin had saved the lives of Magua and the conjurer, who would have been the first victims sacrificed to his own security, had not the scout believed such an act, however congenial it might be to the nature of an Indian, utterly unworthy of one who boasted a descent from men that knew no cross of blood. Accordingly, he trusted to the withes and ligaments with which he had bound his captives, and pursued his way directly towards the center of the lodges. As he approached the buildings, his steps became more deliberate, and his vigilant eye suffered no sign, whether friendly or hostile, to escape him. A neglected hut was a little in advance of the others, and appeared as if it had been deserted when half completed, most probably on account of failing in some of the more important requisites, such as food or water. A faint light glimmered through its cracks, however, and announced that, notwithstanding its imperfect structure, it was not without a tenant. Thither, then, the scout proceeded like a prudent general who was about to feel the advanced positions of his enemy before he hazarded the main attack. Throwing himself into a suitable posture for the beast he represented, Hawkeye crawled to a little opening where he might command a view of the interior. It proved to be the abiding place of David Gamut. Hither the faithful singing master had now brought himself, together with all his sorrows, his apprehensions, and his meek dependence on the protection of Providence. At the precise moment when his ungainly person came under the observation of the scout, in the manner just mentioned, the woodsman himself, though in his assumed character, was the subject of the solitary being's profoundest reflections. However implicit the faith of David was in the performance of ancient miracles, he eschewed the belief of any direct supernatural agency in the management of modern morality. In other words, while he had implicit faith in the ability of Balaam's ass to speak, he was somewhat skeptical on the subject of a bear's singing, and yet he had been assured of the latter on the testimony of his own exquisite organs. There was something in his air and manner that betrayed to the scout the utter confusion of the state of his mind. He was seated on a pile of brush, a few twigs from which occasionally fed his low fire, with his head leaning on his arm in a posture of melancholy musing. The costume of the votary of music had undergone no other alteration from that so lately described, except that he had covered his bald head with a triangular beaver, which had not proved sufficiently alluring to excite the cupidity of any of his captors. The ingenious Hawkeye, who recalled the hasty manner in which the other had abandoned his post at the bedside of the sick woman, was not without his suspicions concerning the subject of so much solemn deliberation. First making the circuit of the hut, and ascertaining that it stood quite alone, and that the character of its inmate was likely to protect it from visitors, he ventured through its low door into the very presence of Gamut. The position of the latter brought the fire between them, and when Hawkeye had seated himself on end, near a minute elapsed, during which the two remained regarding each other without speaking. The suddenness and the nature of the surprise had nearly proved too much for, we will not say the philosophy, but for the faith and resolution of David. He fumbled for his pitchpipe and arose with a confused intention of attempting a musical exorcism.
"Dark and mysterious monster!"
he exclaimed, while with trembling hands he disposed of his auxiliary eyes and sought his never-failing resource in trouble, the gifted version of the Psalms.
"I know not your nature nor intents, but if aught you meditate against the person and rights of one of the humblest servants of the temple, listen to the inspired language of the youth of Israel and repent."
The bear shook his shaggy sides, and then a well-known voice replied, "Put up the tooting weapon and teach your throat modesty. 5 words of plain and comprehensible English are worth just now an hour of squalling."
"What art thou?" demanded David,
utterly disqualified to pursue his original intention and nearly gasping for breath. "A man like yourself, and one whose blood is as little tainted by the cross of a bear or an Indian as your own. Have you so soon forgotten from whom you received the foolish instrument you hold in your hand?"
Can these things be?
Returned David, breathing more freely as the truth began to dawn upon him.
I have found many marvels during my sojourn with the heathen, but surely nothing to excel this.
Come, come, returned Hawkeye, uncasing his honest countenance, the better to assure the wavering confidence of his companion. You may see a skin which, if it be not as white as one of the gentle ones, has no tinge of red to it that the winds of heaven and the sun have not bestowed. Now let us to business.
First tell me of the maiden, and of the youth who so bravely sought her, interrupted David.
Aye, they are happily freed from the tomahawks of these varlets. But can you put me on the scent of Uncas?
The young man is in bondage, and much I fear his death is decreed. I greatly mourn that one so well disposed should die in his ignorance, and I have sought a goodly hymn.
Can you lead me to him?
The task will not be difficult, returned David, hesitating, though I greatly fear your presence would rather increase than mitigate his unhappy fortunes.
No more words, but lead on, returned Hawkeye, concealing his face again, and setting the example in his own person by instantly quitting the lodge. As they proceeded, the scout ascertained that his companion found access to Uncas under privilege of his imaginary infirmity, aided by the favor he had acquired with one of the guards, who, in consequence of speaking a little English, had been selected by David as the subject of a religious conversion. How far the Huron comprehended the intentions of his new friend may well be doubted, but as exclusive attention is as flattering to a savage as to a more civilized individual, it had produced the effect we have mentioned. It is unnecessary to repeat the shrewd manner with which the scout extracted these particulars from the simple David. Neither shall we dwell in this place on the nature of the instructions he delivered when completely master of all the necessary facts, as the whole will be sufficiently explained to the reader in the course of the narrative. The lodge in which Uncas was confined was in the very center of the village, and in a situation, perhaps, more difficult than any other to approach or leave without observation. But it was not the policy of Hawkeye to affect the least concealment. Presuming on his disguise, and his ability to sustain the character he had assumed, he took the most plain and direct route to the place. The hour, however, afforded him some little of that protection which he appeared so much to despise. The boys were already buried in sleep, and all the women and most of the warriors had returned to their lodges for the night. Four or five of the latter only lingered about the door of the prison of Uncas, wary but close observers of the manner of their captive. At the sight of Gamut, accompanied by one in the well-known masquerade of their most distinguished conjurer, they readily made way for them both. Still, they betrayed no intention to depart. On the other hand, they were evidently disposed to remain bound to the place by an additional interest in the mysterious mummeries that they, of course, expected from such a visit. From the total inability of the scout to address the Hurons in their own language, he was compelled to trust the conversation entirely to David. Notwithstanding the simplicity of the latter, he did ample justice to the instructions he had received, more than fulfilling the strongest hopes of his teacher.
"The Delawares are women,"
he exclaimed, addressing himself to the savage who had a slight understanding of the language in which he spoke.
"The Yengeese, my foolish countrymen, have told them to take up the tomahawk and strike their fathers in the Canadas, and they have forgotten their sex. Does my brother wish to hear Le Cerf Agile ask for his petticoats, and see him weep before the Hurons at the stake?"
The exclamation, "Huh!" delivered in a strong tone of assent, announced the gratification the savage would receive in witnessing such an exhibition of weakness in an enemy so long hated and so much feared.
"Then let him step aside, and the cunning man will blow upon the dog. Tell it to thy brothers."
The Huron explained the meaning of David to his fellows, who in their turn listened to the project with that sort of satisfaction that their untamed spirits might be expected to find in such a refinement in cruelty. They drew back a little from the entrance, and motioned to the supposed conjurer to enter. But the bear, instead of obeying, maintained the seat it had taken, and growled.
"The cunning man is afraid that his breath will blow upon his brothers, and take away their courage too,"
continued David, improving the hint he received.
"They must stand farther off."
The Hurons, who would have deemed such a misfortune the heaviest calamity that could befall them, fell back in a body, taking a position where they were out of earshot, though at the same time they could command a view of the entrance to the lodge. Then, as if satisfied of their safety, the scout left his position and slowly entered the place. It was silent and gloomy, being tenanted solely by the captive and lighted by the dying embers of a fire which had been used for the purposes of cookery. Uncas occupied a distant corner in a reclining attitude, being rigidly bound both hands and feet by strong and painful withes. When the frightful object first presented itself to the young Mohican, he did not deign to bestow a single glance on the animal. The scout, who had left David at the door to ascertain they were not observed, thought it prudent to preserve his disguise until assured of their privacy. Instead of speaking, therefore, he exerted himself to enact one of the antics of the animal he represented. The young Mohican, who at first believed his enemies had sent in a real beast to torment him and try his nerves, detected in those performances that to Hayward had appeared so accurate certain blemishes that at once betrayed the counterfeit. Had Hawkeye been aware of the low estimation in which the more skillful Uncas had held his representations, he would probably have prolonged the entertainment a little in pique, but the scornful expression of the young man's eye admitted of so many constructions that the worthy scout was spared the mortification of such a discovery. As soon, therefore, as David gave the preconcerted signal, a low hissing sound was heard in the lodge, in place of the fierce growlings of the bear. Uncas had cast his body back against the wall of the hut, and closed his eyes, as if willing to exclude so contemptible and disagreeable an object from his sight. But the moment the noise of the serpent was heard, he arose and cast his looks on each side of him, bending his head low and turning it inquiringly in every direction, until his keen eye rested on the shaggy monster, where it remained riveted, as though fixed by the power of a charm. Again the same sounds were repeated, evidently proceeding from the mouth of the beast. Once more the eyes of the youth roamed over the interior of the lodge, and returning to their former resting place, he uttered in a deep, suppressed voice, "Hawkeye." "Cut his bands," said Hawkeye to David, who just then approached them. The singer did as he was ordered, and Uncas found his limbs released. At the same moment the dried skin of the animal rattled, and presently the scout arose to his feet in proper person. The Mohican appeared to comprehend the nature of the attempt his friend had made intuitively, neither tongue nor feature betraying another symptom of surprise. When Hawkeye had cast his shaggy vestment, which was done by simply loosing certain thongs of skin, he drew a long glittering knife and put it in the hands of Uncas. "The Red Hurons are without," he said. "Let us be ready." At the same time he laid his finger significantly on another similar weapon, both being the fruits of his prowess among their enemies during the evening. "We will go," said Uncas. "Whither?" "To the tortoises. They are the children of my grandfathers." "Aye, lad," said the scout in English, a language he was apt to use when a little abstracted in mind. "The same blood runs in your veins, I believe. But time and distance have a little changed its color. What shall we do with the Mingos at the door? They count six, and this singer is as good as nothing." "The Hurons are boasters," said Uncas scornfully. "Their totem is a moose, and they run like snails. The Delawares are children of the tortoise, and they outstrip the deer." "Aye, lad, there is truth in what you say. And I doubt not on a rush you would pass the whole nation, and in a straight race of 2 miles would be in and get your breath again afore a knave of them all was within hearing of the other village. But the gift of a white man lies more in his arms than in his legs. As for myself, I can brain a Huron as well as a better man, but when it comes to a race, the knaves would prove too much for me." Uncas, who had already approached the door in readiness to lead the way, now recoiled, and placed himself once more in the bottom of the lodge. But Hawkeye, who was too much occupied with his own thoughts to note the movement, continued speaking more to himself than to his companion. "After all," he said, "it is unreasonable to keep one man in bondage to the gifts of another. So, Uncas, you had better take the leap, while I put on the skin again and trust to cunning for want of speed." The young Mohican made no reply, but quietly folded his arms and leaned his body against one of the upright posts that supported the wall of the hut.
"Well," said the scout, looking up at him, "why do you tarry? There will be time enough for me, as the knaves will give chase to you at first."
"Uncas will stay," was the calm reply.
"For what?"
"To fight with his father's brother, and die with the friend of the Delawares."
"Aye, lad," returned Hawkeye, squeezing the hand of Uncas between his own iron fingers. "'Twould have been more like a Mingo than a Mohican had you left me. But I thought I would make the offer, seeing that youth commonly loves life. Well, what can't be done by main courage in war must be done by circumvention. Put on the skin. I doubt not you can play the bear nearly as well as myself."
Whatever might have been the private opinion of Uncas of their respective abilities in this particular, his grave countenance manifested no opinion of his own superiority. He silently and expeditiously encased himself in the covering of the beast, and then awaited such other movements as his more aged companion saw fit to dictate.
"Now, friend," said Hawkeye, addressing David, "an exchange of garments will be a great convenience to you, inasmuch as you are but little accustomed to the makeshifts of the wilderness. Here, take my hunting shirt and cap, and give me your blanket and hat. You must trust me with the book and spectacles, as well as the tutor, too. If we ever meet again in better times, you shall have all back again, with many thanks into the bargain."
David parted with the several articles named with a readiness that would have done great credit to his liberality, had he not certainly profited in many particulars by the exchange. Hawkeye was not long in assuming his borrowed garments, and when his restless eyes were hid behind the glasses and his head was surmounted by the triangular beaver, as their statures were not dissimilar, he might readily have passed for the singer by starlight. As soon as these dispositions were made, the scout turned to David and gave him his parting instructions.
"Are you much given to cowardice?" he bluntly asked, by way of obtaining a suitable understanding of the whole case before he ventured a prescription.
"My pursuits are peaceful, and my temper, I humbly trust, is greatly given to mercy and love," returned David,
a little nettled at so direct an attack on his manhood.
"But there are none who can say that I have ever forgotten my faith in the Lord, even in the greatest straits."
"Your chiefest danger will be at the moment when the savages find out that they have been deceived. If you are not then knocked in the head, your being a non-compasser will protect you, and you'll then have good reason to expect to die in your bed. If you stay, it must be to sit down here in the shadow and take the part of Uncas, until such times as the cunning of the Indians discover the cheat, when, as I have already said, your time of trial will come. So choose for yourself, to make a rush or tarry here."
"Even so," said David firmly, "I will abide in the place of the Delaware. Bravely and generously has he battled in my behalf, and this and more will I dare in his service."
"You have spoken as a man, and like one who under wiser schooling would have been brought to better things. Hold your head down and draw in your legs. Their formation might tell the truth too early. Keep silent as long as may be, and it would be wise when you do speak to break out suddenly in one of your shoutings, which will serve to remind the Indians that you are not altogether as responsible as men should be. If, however, they take your scalp, as I trust and believe they will not, depend on it, Uncas and I will not forget the deed, but revenge it as becomes true warriors and trusty friends."
"Hold,"
said David, perceiving that with this assurance they were about to leave him.
"I am an unworthy and humble follower of one who taught not the damnable principle of revenge. Should I fall, therefore, seek no victims to my manes, but rather forgive my destroyers, and if you remember them at all, let it be in prayers for the enlightening of their minds and for their eternal welfare."
The scout hesitated and appeared to muse.
"There is a principle in that," he said, "different from the law of the woods, and yet it is fair and noble to reflect upon."
Then, heaving a heavy sigh, probably among the last he ever drew in pining for a condition he had so long abandoned, he added,
"It is what I would wish to practice myself as one without a cross of blood, though it is not always easy to deal with an Indian as you would with a fellow Christian. God bless you, friend. I do believe your scent is not greatly wrong when the matter is duly considered, and keeping eternity before the eyes, though much depends on the natural gifts and the force of temptation." So saying, the scout returned and shook David cordially by the hand, after which act of friendship he immediately left the lodge, attended by the new representative of the beast. The instant Hawkeye found himself under the observation of the Hurons, he drew up his tall form in the rigid manner of David, threw out his arm in the act of keeping time, and commenced what he intended for an imitation of his psalmody. Happily for the success of this delicate adventure, he had to deal with ears but little practiced in the concord of sweet sounds, or the miserable effort would infallibly have been detected. It was necessary to pass within a dangerous proximity of the dark group of the savages, and the voice of the scout grew louder as they drew nigher. When at the nearest point, the Huron who spoke the English thrust out an arm and stopped the supposed singing master. "The Delaware dog," he said, leaning forward and peering through the dim light to catch the expression of the other's features. "Is he afraid? Will the Hurons hear his groans?" A growl so exceedingly fierce and natural proceeded from the beast that the young Indian released his hold and started aside, as if to assure himself that it was not a veritable bear and no counterfeit that was rolling before him. Hawkeye, who feared his voice would betray him to his subtle enemies, gladly profited by the interruption to break out anew in such a burst of musical expression as would, probably, in a more refined state of society, have been termed a grand crash. Among his actual auditors, however, it merely gave him an additional claim to that respect which they never withhold from such as are believed to be the subjects of mental alienation. The little knot of Indians drew back in a body, and suffered, as they thought, the conjurer and his inspired assistant to proceed. It required no common exercise of fortitude in Uncas and the scout to continue the dignified and deliberate pace they had assumed in passing the lodges, especially as they immediately perceived that curiosity had so far mastered fear as to induce the watchers to approach the hut in order to witness the effect of the incantations. The least injudicious or impatient movement on the part of David might betray them, and time was absolutely necessary to ensure the safety of the scout. The loud noise the latter conceived it politic to continue drew many curious gazers to the doors of the different huts as they passed, and once or twice a dark-looking warrior stepped across their path, led to the act by superstition or watchfulness. They were not, however, interrupted, the darkness of the hour and the coldness of the attempt proving their principal friends. The adventurers had got clear of the village and were now swiftly approaching the shelter of the woods when a loud and long cry arose from the lodge where Uncas had been confined. The Mohican started on his feet and shook his shaggy covering as though the animal he counterfeited was about to make some desperate effort. "Hold," said the scout, grasping his friend by the shoulder. "Let them yell again. 'Twas nothing but wonderment." He had no occasion to delay, for the next instant a burst of cries filled the outer air and ran along the whole extent of the village. Uncas cast his skin and stepped forth in his own beautiful proportions. Hawkeye tapped him lightly on the shoulder and glided ahead. "Now let the devils strike our scent," said the scout, tearing two rifles with all their attendant accoutrements from beneath a bush, and flourishing killdeer as he handed Uncas his weapon. "Two, at least, will find it to their deaths." Then, throwing their pieces to a low trail, like sportsmen in readiness for their game, they dashed forward and were soon buried in the somber darkness of the forest. Chapter 27 Antony. I shall remember when Caesar says, "Do this," it is performed. Julius Caesar. The impatience of the savages who lingered about the prison of Uncas, as has been seen, had overcome their dread of the conjurer's breath. They stole cautiously and with beating hearts to a crevice through which the faint light of the fire was glimmering. For several minutes they mistook the form of David for that of their prisoner. But the very accident which Hawkeye had foreseen occurred. Tired of keeping the extremities of his long person so near together, the singer gradually suffered the lower limbs to extend themselves
until one of his misshapen feet actually came in contact with and shoved aside the embers of the fire. At first, the Hurons believed the Delaware had been thus deformed by witchcraft, but when David, unconscious of being observed, turned his head and exposed his simple, mild countenance in place of the haughty lineaments of their prisoner, it would have exceeded the credulity of even a native to have doubted any longer. They rushed together into the lodge, and laying their hands with but little ceremony on their captive, immediately detected the imposition. Then arose the cry first heard by the fugitives. It was succeeded by the most frantic and angry demonstrations of vengeance. David, however firm in his determination to cover the retreat of his friends, was compelled to believe that his own final hour had come. Deprived of his book and his pipe, he was fain to trust to a memory that rarely failed him on such subjects, and breaking forth in a loud and impassioned strain, he endeavored to soothe his passage into the other world by singing the opening verse of a funeral anthem. The Indians were seasonably reminded of his infirmity, and rushing into the open air, they aroused the village in the manner described. A native warrior fights as he sleeps, without the protection of anything defensive. The sounds of the alarm were therefore hardly uttered before 200 men were afoot and ready for the battle or the chase, as either might be required. The escape was soon known, and the whole tribe crowded in a body around the council lodge, impatiently awaiting the instruction of their chiefs. In such a sudden demand on their wisdom, the presence of the cunning Magua could scarcely fail of being needed. His name was mentioned, and all looked round in wonder that he did not appear. Messengers were then dispatched to his lodge requiring his presence. In the meantime, some of the swiftest and most discreet of the young men were ordered to make the circuit of the clearing under cover of the woods, in order to ascertain that their suspected neighbors, the Delawares, designed no mischief. Women and children ran to and fro, and in short, the whole encampment exhibited another scene of wild and savage confusion. Gradually, however, the symptoms of disorder diminished, and in a few minutes the oldest and most distinguished chiefs were assembled in the lodge in grave consultation. The clamor of many voices soon announced that a party approached who might be expected to communicate some intelligence that would explain the mystery of the novel surprise. The crowd without gave way, and several warriors entered the place, bringing with them the hapless conjurer who had been left so long by the scout in duress. Notwithstanding, this man was held in very unequal estimation among the Hurons, some believing implicitly in his power, and others deeming him an impostor. He was now listened to by all with the deepest attention. When his brief story was ended, the father of the sick woman stepped forth, and in a few pithy expressions related in his turn what he knew. These two narratives gave a proper direction to the subsequent inquiries, which were now made with the characteristic cunning of savages. Instead of running in a confused and disorderly throng to the cavern, 10 of the wisest and firmest among the chiefs were selected to prosecute the investigation. As no time was to be lost, the instant the choice was made, the individuals appointed rose in a body and left the place without speaking. On reaching the entrance, the younger men in advance made way for their seniors, and the whole proceeded along the low dark gallery with the firmness of warriors ready to devote themselves to the public good, though at the same time secretly doubting the nature of the power with which they were about to contend. The outer apartment of the cavern was silent and gloomy. The woman lay in her usual place and posture, though there were those present who affirmed they had seen her borne to the woods by the supposed medicine of the white men. Such a direct and palpable contradiction of the tale related by the father caused all eyes to be turned on him. Chafed by the silent imputation and inwardly troubled by so unaccountable a circumstance, the chief advanced to the side of the bed and, stooping, cast an incredulous look at the features as if distrusting their reality. His daughter was dead. The unerring feeling of nature for a moment prevailed, and the old warrior hid his eyes in sorrow. Then, recovering his self-possession, he faced his companions, and pointing towards the corpse, he said in the language of his people, "The wife of my young man has left us. The Great Spirit is angry with his children." The mournful intelligence was received in solemn silence. After a short pause, one of the elder Indians was about to speak, when a dark-looking object was seen rolling out of an adjoining compartment into the very center of the room where they stood. Ignorant of the nature of the beings they had to deal with, the whole party drew back a little and gazed in admiration until the object fronted the light and, rising on end, exhibited the distorted but still fierce and sullen features of Magua. The discovery was succeeded by a general exclamation of amazement. As soon, however, as the true situation of the chief was understood, several ready knives appeared, and his limbs and tongue were quickly released. The Huron arose and shook himself like a lion quitting his lair. Not a word escaped him, though his hand played convulsively with the handle of his knife, while his lowering eyes scanned the whole party as if they sought an object suited to the first burst of his vengeance. It was happy for Uncas and the scout, and even David, that they were all beyond the reach of his arm at such a moment. For assuredly, no refinement in cruelty would then have deferred their deaths, in opposition to the promptings of the fierce temper that nearly choked him. Meeting everywhere faces that he knew as friends, the savage grated his teeth together like rasps of iron, and swallowed his passion for want of a victim on whom to vent it. This exhibition of anger was noted by all present, and from an apprehension of exasperating a temper that was already chafed nearly to madness, several minutes were suffered to pass before another word was uttered. When, however, suitable time had elapsed, the oldest of the party spoke.
"My friend has found an enemy," he said. "Is he nigh, that the Hurons may take revenge?" "Let the Delaware die!" exclaimed Magua in a voice of thunder.
Another long and expressive silence was observed, and was broken, as before, with due precaution by the same individual.
"The Mohican is swift of foot and leaps far," he said, "but my young men are on his trail." "Is he gone?" demanded Magua in tones so deep and guttural that they seemed to proceed from his inmost chest.
"An evil spirit has been among us, and the Delaware has blinded our eyes."
"An evil spirit?" repeated the other mockingly. "'Tis the spirit that has taken the lives of so many Hurons, the spirit that slew my young men at the Tumbling River, that took their scalps at the Healing Spring, and who has now bound the arms of Lorena Sutil."
"Of whom does my friend speak?"
"Of the dog who carries the heart and cunning of a Huron under a pale skin, La Longue Carabine."
The pronunciation of so terrible a name produced the usual effect among his auditors. But when time was given for reflection, and the warriors remembered that their formidable and daring enemy had even been in the bosom of their encampment, working injury, fearful rage took the place of wonder, and all those fierce passions with which the bosom of Magua had just been struggling were suddenly transferred to his companions. Some among them gnashed their teeth in anger, others vented their feelings in yells, and some, again, beat the air as frantically as if the object of their resentment were suffering under their blows. But this sudden outbreaking of temper as quickly subsided in the still and sullen restraint they most affected in their moments of inaction. Magua, who had in his turn found leisure for reflection, now changed his manner and assumed the air of one who knew how to think and act with a dignity worthy of so grave a subject.
"Let us go to my people," he said. "They wait for us."
His companions consented in silence, and the whole of the savage party left the cavern and returned to the council lodge. When they were seated, all eyes turned on Magua, who understood from such an indication that by common consent they had devolved the duty of relating what had passed on him. He arose and told his tale without duplicity or reservation. The whole deception practiced by both Duncan and Hawkeye was, of course, laid naked, and no room was found, even for the most superstitious of the tribe, any longer to affix a doubt on the character of the occurrences. It was but too apparent that they had been insultingly, shamefully, disgracefully deceived. When he had ended and resumed his seat, the collected tribe, for his auditors in substance included all the fighting men of the party, sat regarding each other like men astonished equally at the audacity and the success of their enemies. The next consideration, however, was the means and opportunities for revenge. Additional pursuers were sent on the trail of the fugitives, And then the chiefs applied themselves in earnest to the business of consultation. Many different expedients were proposed by the elder warriors in succession, to all of which Magua was a silent and respectful listener. That subtle savage had recovered his artifice and self-command, and now proceeded towards his object with his customary caution and skill. It was only when each one disposed to speak had uttered his sentiments that he prepared to advance his own opinions. They were given with additional weight from the circumstance that some of the rumors had already returned and reported that their enemies had been traced so far as to leave no doubt of their having sought safety in the neighboring camp of their suspected allies, the Delawares. With the advantage of possessing this important intelligence, the chief warily laid his plans before his fellows, and, as might have been anticipated from his eloquence and cunning, they were adopted without a dissenting voice. They were briefly as follows, both in opinions and in motives. It has been already stated that, in obedience to a policy rarely departed from, the sisters were separated so soon as they reached the Huron village. Magua had early discovered that in retaining the person of Alice, he possessed the most effectual check on Cora. When they parted, therefore, he kept the former within reach of his hand, consigning the one he most valued to the keeping of their allies. The arrangement was understood to be merely temporary, and was made as much with a view to flatter his neighbors as in obedience to the invariable rule of Indian policy. While goaded incessantly by those revengeful impulses that in a savage seldom slumber, the chief was still attentive to his more permanent personal interests. The follies and disloyalty committed in his youth were to be expiated by a long and painful penance ere he could be restored to the full enjoyment of the confidence of his ancient people. And without confidence there could be no authority in an Indian tribe. In this delicate and arduous situation, the crafty native had neglected no means of increasing his influence, and one of the happiest of his expedients had been the success with which he had cultivated the favor of their powerful and dangerous neighbors. The result of his experiment had answered all the expectations of his policy. For the Hurons were in no degree exempt from that governing principle of nature which induces man to value his gifts precisely in the degree that they are appreciated by others. But while he was making this ostensible sacrifice to general considerations, Magua never lost sight of his individual motives. The latter had been frustrated by the unlooked-for events which had placed all his prisoners beyond his control, and he now found himself reduced to the necessity of suing for favors to those whom it had so lately been his policy to oblige. Several of the chiefs had proposed deep and treacherous schemes to surprise the Delawares, and by gaining possession of their camp to recover their prisoners by the same blow, for all agreed that their honor, their interests, and the peace and happiness of their dead countrymen imperiously required them speedily to immolate some victims to their revenge. But plans so dangerous to attempt, and of such doubtful issue, Magua found little difficulty in defeating. He exposed their risk and fallacy with his usual skill, and it was only after he had removed every impediment in the shape of opposing advice that he ventured to propose his own projects. He commenced by flattering the self-love of his auditors, a never-failing method of commanding attention. When he had enumerated the many different occasions on which the Hurons had exhibited their courage and prowess in the punishment of insults, he digressed in a high encomium on the virtue of wisdom. He painted the quality as forming the great point of difference between the beaver and other brutes, between brutes and men, and finally between the Hurons in particular and the rest of the human race. After he had sufficiently extolled the property of discretion, he undertook to exhibit in what manner its use was applicable to the present situation of their tribe. On the one hand, he said, was their great pale father, the governor of the Canadas, who had looked upon his children with a hard eye since their tomahawks had been so red. On the other hand, a people, as numerous as themselves, who spoke a different language, possessed different interests, and loved them not, and who would be glad of any pretense to bring them in disgrace with the great white chief. Then he spoke of their necessities, of the gifts they had a right to expect for their past services, of their distance from their proper hunting grounds and native villages, and of the necessity of consulting prudence more and inclination less in so critical circumstances. When he perceived that while the old men applauded his moderation, many of the fiercest and most distinguished of the warriors listened to these politic plans with lowering looks, he cunningly led them back to the subject which they most loved. He spoke openly of the fruits of their wisdom, which he boldly pronounced would be a complete and final triumph over their enemies. He even darkly hinted that their success might be extended with proper caution in such a manner as to include the destruction of all whom they had reason to hate. In short, he so blended the warlike with the artful, the obvious with the obscure, as to flatter the propensities of both parties, and to leave to each subject of hope, while neither could say it clearly comprehended his intentions. The orator, or the politician who can produce such a state of things, is commonly popular with his contemporaries, however he may be treated by posterity. All perceived that more was meant than was uttered, and each one believed that the hidden meaning was precisely such as his own faculties enabled him to understand, or his own wishes led him to anticipate. In this happy state of things, it is not surprising that the management of Magua prevailed. The tribe consented to act with deliberation, and with one voice they committed the direction of the whole affair to the government of the chief who had suggested such wise and intelligible expedients. Magua had now attained one great object of all his cunning and enterprise. The ground he had lost in the favor of his people was completely regained, and he found himself even placed at the head of affairs. He was, in truth, their ruler. And so long as he could maintain his popularity, no monarch could be more despotic, especially while the tribe continued in a hostile country. Throwing off, therefore, the appearance of consultation, he assumed the grave air of authority necessary to support the dignity of his office. Runners were dispatched for intelligence in different directions. Spies were ordered to approach and feel the encampment of the Delawares. The warriors were dismissed to their lodges with an intimation that their services would soon be needed, and the women and children were ordered to retire with a warning that it was their province to be silent. When these several arrangements were made, Magua passed through the village, stopping here and there to pay a visit where he thought his presence might be flattering to the individual. He confirmed his friends in their confidence, fixed the wavering, and gratified all. Then he sought his own lodge. The wife the Huron chief had abandoned when he was chased from among his people was dead. Children he had none, and he now occupied a hut without companion of any sort. It was, in fact, the dilapidated and solitary structure in which David had been discovered, and whom he had tolerated in his presence on those few occasions when they met with the contemptuous indifference of a haughty superiority. Hither, then, Magua retired, when his labors of policy were ended. While others slept, however, he neither knew nor sought repose. Had there been one sufficiently curious to have watched the movements of the newly elected chief, he would have seen him seated in a corner of his lodge, musing on the subject of his future plans, from the hour of his retirement to the time he had appointed for the warriors to assemble again. Occasionally the air breathed through the crevices of the hut, and the low flames that fluttered about the embers of the fire threw their wavering light on the person of the sullen recluse. At such moments it would not have been difficult to have fancied the dusky savage the Prince of Darkness, brooding on his own fancied wrongs and plotting evil. Long before the day dawned, however, warrior after warrior entered the solitary hut of Magua, until they had collected to the number of 20. Each bore his rifle, and all the other accoutrements of war, though the paint was uniformly peaceful. The entrance of these fierce-looking beings was unnoticed, some seating themselves in the shadows of the place, and others standing like motionless statues until the whole of the designated band was collected. Then Magua arose and gave the signal to proceed, marching himself in advance. They followed their leader singly, and in that well-known order which has obtained the distinguishing appellation of Indian file. Unlike other men engaged in the spirit-stirring business of war, They stole from their camp unostentatiously and unobserved, resembling a band of gliding specters, more than warriors seeking the bubble reputation by deeds of desperate daring. Instead of taking the path which led directly towards the camp of the Delawares, Magua led his party for some distance down the windings of the stream and along the little artificial lake of the beavers. The day began to dawn as they entered the clearing which had been formed by those sagacious and industrious animals. Though Magua, who had resumed his ancient garb, bore the outline of a fox on his dressed skin which formed his robe, there was one chief of his party who carried the beaver as his peculiar symbol or totem. There would have been a species of profanity in the omission had this man passed so powerful a community of his fancied kindred without bestowing some evidence of his regard. Accordingly, he paused and spoke in words as kind and friendly as if he were addressing more intelligent beings. He called the animals his cousins and reminded them that his protecting influence was the reason they remained unharmed, while so many avaricious traders were prompting the Indians to take their lives. He promised a continuance of his favors and admonished them to be grateful, after which he spoke of the expedition in which he was himself engaged and intimated, though with sufficient delicacy and circumlocution, the expediency of bestowing on their relative a portion of that wisdom for which they were so renowned. During the utterance of this extraordinary address, the companions of the speaker were as grave and as attentive to his language as though they were all equally impressed with its propriety. Once or twice, black objects were seen rising to the surface of the water, and the Huron expressed pleasure, conceiving that his words were not bestowed in vain. Just as he had ended his address, the head of a large beaver was thrust from the door of a lodge whose earthen walls had been much injured and which the party had believed from its situation to be uninhabited. Such an extraordinary sign of confidence was received by the orator as a highly favorable omen, and though the animal retreated a little precipitately, he was lavish of his thanks and commendations. When Magua thought sufficient time had been lost in gratifying the family affection of the warrior, he again made the signal to proceed. As the Indians moved away in a body and with a step that would have been inaudible to the ears of any common man, the same venerable-looking beaver once more ventured his head from its cover. Had any of the Hurons turned to look behind them, they would have seen the animal watching their movements with an interest and sagacity that might easily have been mistaken for reason. Indeed, so very distinct and intelligible were the devices of the quadruped that even the most experienced observer would have been at a loss to account for its actions, until the moment when the party entered the forest, when the whole would have been explained by seeing the entire animal issue from the lodge, uncasing by the act the grave features of Chingachgook from his mask of fur.